If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group,
or if you've had experience with manipulation or abuse of power that you'd like to share,
leave us a message on our hotline number at 347-86-TRUST.
That's 347-868-7878.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers, don't.
Welcome, welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and manipulation from two investigative journalists who've actually experienced it. I'm Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth. We're not investigative journalists.
I mean, we're not not.
We're not
but
not.
We also aren't. Really?
Okay, fair.
We're podcasters, you guys. Today, in our first episode of Conspiracy Month, we are focusing this month, every week, we're talking to a different person about conspiracy theories and how they happen and who they happen to, et cetera, et cetera. For this first week of Conspiracy Month, we're going to talk to Lisa Fazio. So she is an associate professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University, and she researches learning, memory, and how we come to believe falsehoods. Because, after all, conspiracy theorists believe in a whole lot of things that have no evidence. Lisa's going to talk to us about why none of us are the experts in discerning fact from fiction that we think we are, and how therefore we're all vulnerable to made-up stories, and how hearing something multiple times makes it seem more true, even if we know it isn't, and no matter who's saying it.
Scary. She'll talk to us about why misinformation spreads so easily on the internet, how falsehoods stick in our memory even after we learn that they're not true, and the ways we can protect ourselves from falling prey to bad information that might lead us into conspiracy theory territory.
So much to get into, you guys. I'm really excited about this month.
Oh, me too.
So instead of doing a cultiest thing this week, we are just going to talk about a very culty thing that is happening in the news. Maybe y'all have read about it. So maybe y'all have seen this story that has started to come up in the news about a polygamist leader who claimed 20 wives, including minors, right? So there's this big story that's coming out now. This man, Samuel Bateman, in southern Utah and Arizona on the border, took underage wives, and it is very, very terrible, the things that he's done. So if you look in the court documents, if you look in the affidavit, and some of the articles reference this, most of the evidence is coming from two people, and it only says their initials. It's ZM and it's TK, and it says that most of the recordings, their audio recordings, their video recordings, come from these two people who got close to this cult leader. The two people in question are my mom and my stepdad. I mean, I didn't know the specifics. I did not know the details, but I have known that my mom has been secretly like taking down a cult leader from the inside for the past, over a year. And you guys,
I mean, just to say, Christine was our first guest.
She was our first guest.
Trust Me, she was in a cult of her own. So this is dear to her heart. And these women are important to her in many other ways. She's been a friend to them. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's stressful for me to even talk about because I care so much about like just how this is all going to go down. And like my mom has put herself in a lot of danger to take this person down. She's like, I mean, it's just been a very emotionally challenging year for her because like, you know, her focus is on harm reduction in the community, and therefore she's built up a lot of trust with a lot of people in this area. And this group, these women, these girls, they trusted her. And
oh, it makes me want to cry.
I know. And she's like, you know, she's called me like crying because she's like, they love me so much. Like they love me so much. And they don't know. They don't know that what's happening to them is abuse. And they don't know that I'm about to betray their trust. But I have to do it. Because there is some very serious abuse happening.
Yes, it's the law also.
Yeah. But so again, like whatever, some of the details have come out now and you guys can read about them on your own. We're not going to talk about them today because we're going to do a whole episode on it later on. But there were some really, really just like disgusting, vile sex acts that were happening with underage girls, very young girls, family members, like really just like horrible shit. And having to hear about that stuff, I just like can't imagine how you keep going and have to like keep putting on a smile. And because, you know, she first talked to authorities about it 2 years ago. And basically it took so long to like actually get enough concrete evidence. And I want to just like mention really fast, there's a group of women online.
Uh-oh.
We've talked about them before. They drive me crazy. So there's this group of women. I'm going to say that they are, they consider themselves like cult fighters or something. And they will talk about, you know, all of the why polygamy is wrong and helping polygamists is wrong. And therefore, my mom has become sort of the object of their hatred. So they knew that my mom was in this community. They did not know that my mom was like secretly gathering evidence with the authorities for many months. They basically have been saying my mom is an enabler and she should be in jail herself. And I just would like to kindly say to these women, suck my dick.
Oh,
suck my dick. Talk to me when you are secretly fucking recording 4 months and putting yourself in danger and also just like exposing yourself emotionally to so much difficult shit when you are actually on the front line, literally fighting cults, literally taking a man down.
It's
as opposed
nuanced,
to like typing on your computer.
It's a nuanced thing, right? You know, I mean, everything that we talk about here, it's so nuanced. It's not as easy as you can just type it out at a computer. It's a complicated subject with people who aren't. It's so hard because I want to say with people who aren't thinking rationally, but then I feel like I'm taking away their empowerment. It's just so complicated.
I mean, I understand the instinct. Like we all have this instinct to like want to see, find the good people and the bad people and pick the good people and then fight, you know, fight the bad people. And it's like, but sometimes we get it wrong. We get it wrong.
Yeah.
And in this case, these women got it wrong. And as evidenced by lots of court documents at this point. And so, you know, it brings me great joy to like be able to talk about it now. I mean, we will talk about it more in depth. My mom does not. She's not doing interviews. She has like a court case to deal with and the like aftermath to deal with. It's been very difficult. And so she's not talking about it right now, but I'm talking about it because I love my mom. I love my mommy.
And you love the women that she's helping.
I do. And I have met a couple of the people who are named in the court documents and this has been hell for them. This whole process has been hell for them. And like, I want to really speak to the bravery of them too, to like be able to come forward. For now, I'll just say my mom rules and
we love you, Christine.
We're taking. So basically, this man is in jail largely because of my mom and my stepdad. And I think that's freaking awesome. And we will see what happens in court. But that's my cultiest thing.
Whew.
That aside.
Yeah.
That like pretty important thing aside. Should we talk to Lisa Fazio now?
Let's get into it.
Welcome, Lisa Fazio, to Trust Me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. We're so excited, aren't we, Megan?
It's kind of crazy. I'm like, I'm very excited to know so many things.
Yeah. So you focus on the process of learning and memory and specifically how we come to believe things that are not true. That's one of your areas of emphasis. So what drew you to research these topics in particular?
Yeah. So I've been researching these topics for a long time. I first got interested when I was an undergraduate at Washington University in St. Louis. And I started learning from these professors who were researching memory and specifically all the ways that our memories can be wrong. So how we can come to have false beliefs of events that never happened that we think actually did happen, and how our memories get twisted as we start retelling stories. And so I thought this was fascinating. And then it shifted from work on these kind of memories for events in our lives to our knowledge about real world events and people.
Oh, it makes me want to do a whole other branch off episode on false memories and the satanic panic because I'm so interested in that stuff. But for today, we're going to focus on our current landscape. So most of us see ourselves as experts in discerning fact from fiction. And I would love to know why we are wrong.
That's a great way of framing it. So it actually turns out that it's really hard for humans to determine what's true or false, especially if the information is kind of close enough or good enough. If something's blatantly wrong, you'll normally notice the error and realize it's false. But the things that are more plausible, it can be really tough. So I'll give you guys my favorite example. I'm going to ask you two questions. Just answer them both out loud. In the biblical story, what was Jonah swallowed by?
A whale.
A whale.
Good job. How many animals of each kind did Moses take on the ark?
Two. What, Moses? Was it Moses?
Yeah. I read this example in advance, so I feel like it's not fair for me to answer. but when I was reading, it was two. Yeah.
Yeah. But then you started to realize that, yeah, it was actually Noah and not Moses.
Oh, shit. Thanks, parents, for really thumping the Bible into my brain. Okay, right. I hear you. I get it. Okay, cool.
So if I had just asked you kind of who was it who took the animals on the ark, you probably could have come up with Noah. If I'd given you a multiple choice question, you definitely would have come up with Noah. But in that moment, when I say Moses, nothing registers as wrong. You just kind of go on comprehending the sentence as if it's perfectly normal.
Right.
So it's like it sounds close enough to the thing that there's no reason for our brains to like kind of flag it to stop and notice that.
100%. And so if you do it with things that are blatantly false, so in the original study back in the 80s, they asked how many animals of each kind did Reagan take on the ark? everyone notices the error there. They don't answer the question. But if it's close enough, it's if it's in this same general kind of plausible frame, we tend not to notice it. And we think part of that is when we're communicating with people, we make all sorts of errors. I'm sure you guys have noticed this from podcasting and transcripts.
Yes.
Like, if you actually transcribe speech, there's all sorts of errors and missing information in there. And we just kind of fill it in and go along with the flow because our goal isn't to be 100% accurate. Our goal is to exchange information, form community, learn from each other.
Right. So mental shortcuts, heuristics, what are those? And like, why do our brains pick the path of least resistance?
Yeah, so our brains are designed to be efficient. It takes a lot of glucose, a lot of energy to kind of have all these neurons firing, have all these connections going. And so when we can take shortcuts, we tend to do so. And these shortcuts exist because they normally work. Because 90, 99% of the time, the shortcut's going to get you what you need without disastrous consequences.
Right.
But you get these interesting problems when sometimes those shortcuts don't work. And so that's what we find with a lot of this stuff on false information, where it would be really, really time consuming and resource heavy to check everything that you hear against your prior knowledge. And do this kind of exact check. So instead, we just check, is it good enough, close enough?
Right. And so if we see ourselves as the exception and like don't really recognize that we are all engaging in these mental shortcuts all the time, does that put us more at risk of believing in false things?
Oh, it's a really good question. I will say that there is variation. So some people are better at distinguishing what's true and false than other people. Some people are more likely to use these shortcuts than other people. But what we have found is that groups that tend to think they'll be protected, so people with more education, in the U.S. right now, where so much of the misinformation is targeting Republicans and conservatives, liberals tend to think that they're not vulnerable to it. And we've shown over and over again that that's not true.
Right.
These factors don't fully protect you against these effects.
Right. I mean, it makes sense. If you think that your thinking is better than other people's thinking, you're going to be less likely to stop and like actually ponder the information that you're getting because you're like, oh, well, I'm a good thinker, so I've got the education or whatever, you know?
Totally.
Let's start talking about repetition. What is the illusory truth effect?
Yeah. So the illusory truth effect is our fancy name for this basic finding that is if you repeat something, people are more likely to think that it's true. So the second time you've heard a statement, the third time you've heard a statement, you're a little more likely to think that it's true than the first time that you've heard something.
And why is that?
Partially, it's again one of these heuristics that in the real world, things that you've heard lots of times are more likely to be true. There is this natural correlation in the real world between repetition and truth. And so what we think is happening is that our brains are realizing this correlation exists and then starting to use kind of cues from repetition to make judgments about truth. In the lab, we normally study this by having people see a list of trivia statements and then repeating some of them, not repeating others, and seeing if they rate it on a scale of kind of definitely false to definitely true, how do those ratings change with repetition?
What if it's something that you're inherently like, no to, I don't believe that? Does the repetition change anything there, or does your no to it just get stronger over time?
So I wish it worked the way that you suggested at the end, where like your no would just get stronger, but it seems to actually work the other way. So we found even for statements that contradict your prior knowledge. So 2 weeks earlier, you were able to tell us that the one-eyed giant is a cyclops in Greek mythology. If you then hear the statement, the one-eyed giant in Greek mythology is called a minotaur twice, you're still more likely to think it's true as compared to the first time you hear it.
That is
even though
so
we
insane.
Know that you've got that wow. information in your head.
You know, I feel like I notice this in practice in real life with like there'll be certain conspiracy theories going around, and you know, most of my friends are not really that into conspiracy theories. It's not really the kind of crew I hang with. But every once in a while, if something gets like goes around on TikTok enough, there will start to be this like, well, there's a little bit of truth to that, that like I'll notice happening. And I mean, I've even done it in myself when I've experienced some skepticism about something I see on the internet. And then when I see enough people like talking about it, I'm like, is that true? Did I miss something? Was there like a, you know, was I just being the knee jerk liberal who's like not responding, not taking in information well or something? So yeah, so that is interesting. I mean, we had another guest on our show a couple months ago, Chris Bale. He's the director of the Polarization Lab at Duke. So he was talking about how like we can be in our social media bubbles online. He posits basically that an echo chamber has less to do with your environment and more about playing into your like existing beliefs. I wonder if you have any thoughts or know of any research or have conducted any research on like if somebody is in your out-group, for example, is it kind of the same thing?
Yeah. So there's not a ton of research yet looking at kind of political information, but there's a little bit. So my colleagues, David Rand at MIT and Gordon Pennycook, soon to be at Cornell, they did a study where people saw true and false political news headlines. And these were either new or repeated during the experiment. And then they compared how kind of pro-Democrat and pro-Republican headlines were judged by both Democrats and Republicans. So you might think that repetition is going to increase your belief in the things that kind of you're primed to agree with. So maybe a false headline about Hillary Clinton if you're a Republican. But maybe it won't increase your belief in statements that you don't want to believe in. But that's not what they found. Mm. What they found was a really similar increase for both these headlines that kind of confirmed your existing prior beliefs and the ones that went against it.
Wow.
So at baseline, you're more likely to believe false headlines about your opponent than about your in-group. Mm-hmm. But with repetition, both of those groups increased equally.
So if I'm Q of QAnon fame, and I'm like, okay, I want to convince my followers of like XYZ crazy things, the strategy for doing that would be to like just get a lot of people to say it over and over and over again, get a lot of famous people to say it, get it on the news, and eventually I will like cultivate a growing following, like maybe not only, but like largely, or at least in great part, due to the repetition.
Yeah. And in that cycle that you just mentioned, what you really see is all of these forces intersecting, where you do commonly see this pattern where a new rumor or conspiracy will bubble up from kind of dark corners of the internet, 8chan or something like that. And their goal is really to get the narrative out of that bubble and into more mainstream places. So can we get this now on Twitter? Once it's on Twitter, can we get someone with a high following to talk about it?
Elon Musk.
Once someone with a high following is talking about it, well, now major newspapers are covering it.
Right.
And now you've gotten something that was nothing, that 30 people were talking about in a forum, to something that now there's mainstream coverage of.
The internet needs to be illegal. Just kidding.
I do find that terrifying, though. It's scary.
It is so scary. I mean, all of these things, these processing shortcuts worked great, I'm sure, 40 years ago even. But now there's so much, there's infinite information that we're just like, just, it's so wild how much our brain is processing and the weird shortcuts we don't even know that we're taking.
I think TikTok is a great app. There's so much great stuff on it, but I do find it to be very scary in terms of how much and how quickly misinformation is spreading on there. Like, you know, there's this Balenciaga like panic. It is crazy how like one thing that is true kind of like sets a wildfire and turns into all of these other things. And these like, all of this bias is just like spreading like wildfire. And when you actually like pause and look at like what evidence is there, it's like, well, there's not evidence of that much. There's evidence of like this one thing, but like not these other 20 things that you guys took it to. It scares me a lot.
Interesting.
I was just going to say one of the scary things about TikTok and kind of one of the things about how it exists as a platform is that when you see information on there, it's stripped of almost any information about its source or its credibility.
Right, exactly.
So when you see someone talking on TikTok, you don't typically know if they are an expert in that field or if they're just spouting out nonsense off the top of their head. Kind of both of those are going to be presented equivalently to you
right.
in the app.
I just want to touch on why familiarity, why repetition works in this way. And so can you define processing fluency?
Yeah. So processing fluency is the psychology term we use for kind of how easy a statement is to process. So if you've heard something before, the second time you hear it, it's just a little easier to process. You get this sense of fluency as you're encountering it. And we've got some evidence that this sense of fluency, this sense of ease, is what you're using to make those truth judgments. So when things are easier to process, you're more likely to think they're true. So there's a cool study that looked at kind of rhyming aphorisms. So like little sayings that either do or don't rhyme. People tend to think the rhyming ones are a little more likely
That's true. Foxy Noxy, Amanda Knox.
Yeah, we had Amanda Knox on our show to talk about different biases and heuristics, and that was Megan's favorite one.
Yeah. Yeah. Foxy Noxy, guilty. Guilty as charged.
Yeah, except not.
No, she's not, no.
She's not.
Except for let's lay that flat.
Yeah.
The other one is that if you present statements in kind of easy to read fonts, mm-hmm. people think they're more likely to be true than if they're in like a hard to read, like yellow font.
Interesting.
Right. So this makes me think of like all of our grandparents on Facebook. So they are getting these memes are getting shared that have these like kind of flashy looking images that are making some exaggerated claim usually, and the really big font that's like really easy to read, and it captures your attention right away. Is that part of why misinformation spreads so much? Because it's just like so easy to like see it and know what the message is supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, one of the tricks is that when you're lying, you can make up the simplest story you want and make it super easy to understand, super catchy. When you're trying to deal with the truth, there tends to be caveats and exceptions and all of this complication that really doesn't make for this like short, catchy catchphrase.
Right.
Yeah. You said somewhere that fake news spreads some insane amount faster than real news. Is that correct?
There's some studies, they're not my favorite studies. There's small issues there. But in general, it's definitely true that false information spreads really quickly, really far on social media.
It is interesting. It's like and this is one of the things that I get like really depressed about and like go to a really dark place with, because I'm like, no one cares about truth. But the truth is like complicated usually and nuanced, and it requires a lot of brain power to like really understand how complex an issue is. And most of us, most of the time, are not in a space to want to do that mental work. It's difficult. And it's like, bro, I just got home from work. Like, I'm not trying to like get to the bottom of who is right about this complicated issue. Like, just tell me who's right. What is it? Is the world black and white? Like, because that's easier and also more exciting, because, you know, if there's like an evil cabal controlling everything, well, that's a more exciting life, you know, to like get to the bottom of that mystery than just like, well, actually, it's a bunch of disparate people who have conflicting ideas and beliefs, and they're all, there's a confluence of events. It's like, it's just not as interesting, but also not as easy to understand.
Well, and I think that gets at an important factor that people often forget about conspiracy theories. They're really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, they tend to be exciting. You're in the know. You know something other people don't. You're doing this active investigation to try and figure out what's going on. It's an enjoyable activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So if I'm a politician or a cult leader, how might I use this to my advantage?
Yeah. So, I mean, the repetition effects mean that you want to come up with kind of a simple message and repeat that message a lot.
Yeah.
I've been trying to tell people that you can use this for good as well. So public interest communicators, nonprofits, you don't have to cede the space to disinformers.
Right.
You can also come up with kind of short, easy to understand messages that you can repeat over and over again. Part of what we're seeing is you don't want to always be the one having to react to what someone else is saying.
Right.
You want to push out your own messaging as well. Rather than just constantly saying, no, that's wrong, no, that's wrong.
What's a good example of like a good message that's just concise? Like, you, what have you seen that you're like, you, that's good?
Ooh, that's a good question. One that I've seen a fair amount recently is just vaccines are safe and effective.
Mm. But even that, it's like, it does feel like that is a reaction to everyone else being like, they're not safe and they're not effective.
Exactly.
Right?
No, it still is.
It's so complicated.
Yeah, it reinforces my thing where I'm like, oh, we are all just like constantly living in an information war. And we are like, we have to like try to find the truth in this war of information. Everything is marketing. Everything is branding. You know, everything is like whose message is getting out there the most, because we are unfortunately all susceptible to it no matter what.
Yep.
So tell us about the continued influence effect. What is that?
Yeah. So this is the finding that even when you correct misinformation, it still has some subtle influences on your belief.
Mm.
So the famous studies that have looked at this, you tend to read a story about a fire in a warehouse. And in the original story, that you're told that kind of there were these canisters of gas, and that it was a suspected arson. And then later on, you're told, oh, wait, there was no arson. Actually, the fire occurred for some other reason, whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then later on, you can look at kind of what do people believe happened? And they might believe you that kind of, oh, all right, those canisters of gas weren't actually there because you told me they weren't. But they still might kind of believe that there was more, that it was likely to be arson,
or
at least more likely than someone who didn't read the story to begin with. So the continued influence effect is really this finding that while misinformation debunks and fact checks are really effective, they don't get you all the way back down to kind of baseline or before you had seen the false information.
Right. So it sounds almost the same as the primacy effect. Is that kind of the same thing, where the first piece of information you hear is the one
likely
to
stick?
Yeah,
it's similar in some ways to that.
How is it different?
I think it could be different. I think it's slightly different in that you could get a continued influence effect even if like someone saw the true information.
I see.
Then you saw the false information, then you debunked them, you'd still see a continued influence effect.
So given this effect, given both of these effects, the continued influence effect, the primacy effect, how do we free ourselves from false information once we've learned it, if it has this tendency to kind of stick?
So one of the ways we found that's useful is to replace the original false narrative with a new kind of causal chain of events. So it's more effective if I say, you know what, it wasn't arson. Instead, it was an electrical fire caused by a faulty electrician.
Mm.
Well, now you've been able to kind of replace your mental model, your understanding of what the event was, and it's more memorable. And that's a lot more memorable than just going, no, not arson.
Oh, that is so interesting. I feel like that this is something I think about a lot in terms of, like, this might be a weird analogy, but like in communication with a partner, it's not useful at all to tell them what not to do. It's like our brain doesn't process the absence of things. It's not that, or don't do that. It's like the most effective way to like get behaviors to change, and it sounds like to get information to stick, is to be like, no, this is what happened, and have like something more active to kind of remember.
Yep, exactly. And so we find that kind of simple true false labels and kind of little debunks can be effective. They're definitely better than nothing, but the most effective debunks come when you can replace it with a new narrative.
Yeah, it's like fighting story with story. We need story.
And so if I'm a social media platform, how would I combat that? Because right now we have like, this might be false, but right, that's not going to be effective. So what is effective?
Yeah. So these kind of mealy, this might be false, are again better than nothing.
Okay.
I wouldn't want people to stop doing them. They are better than having nothing there, but they're not as effective as these more kind of full-throated, clear statements. Here's what's true. This is false. This is why it's false. Here's a better source of information, those types of debunks. The problem is, of course, that those are really hard to do.
Yeah.
They take time.
Yeah.
They take some kind of message crafting. As we talked about, truth is complicated in ways that lies aren't. So I think this can be a part of our interventions, but it can't be the only thing that we're doing. And I think one of the more promising things is to reduce the spread of misinformation at the front end so that less people are exposed to the false information.
Right.
And is that like a bots situation, or where do we start on that?
Yeah. So one thing that platforms can do is actually pay more attention to the behavior of their biggest users. So who has the biggest following? And maybe with big followings comes more responsibility. We're going to be more, we're going to pay more attention to what you're sharing and whether or not it's reliable information.
Right.
So right now it's often easier for platforms to kick off people without many followers because there's no big pushback. Or to reduce the spread of what they're sharing, it's much more difficult for them to handle people with many millions of followers. But those are the very people who can cause the most damage.
I mean, I just keep thinking about Elon Musk and how Elon Musk is the seems to have been blackpilled a little bit, but also like owns Twitter now. So Twitter just seems like it's become a vastly more dangerous place all of a sudden. I mean, dangerous in terms of ideas.
It also just, it's really confusing because who holds that power of like, this is misinformation. Can it be you? Because you seem like a very rational person, but you know.
This is one of the big issues. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we don't want the government doing it.
Because we had that misinformation board, Mary Poppins girl, who was like singing about stuff that wasn't, like, it was misinformation too sometimes. So it's like, who does it? I don't know.
Right.
Right. So most people don't want the government involved in that because it's icky. We don't want private companies to be in charge of it because their incentives aren't aligned with kind of public good. So there's some thoughts of kind of we need to add regulations to the industry. So maybe private companies are doing it, but doing it under guidelines that have been created. It's a tricky problem.
It needs to be a robot. It needs to be an ethically programmed robot.
So most of the platforms are currently using AI to identify misinformation.
Wow.
How well trained those AIs are and how much they're doing good versus harm are kind of open aspects of research. And it's hard to get that data because platforms don't want to share that type of information.
I don't trust in it. I feel like you could just develop a misinformation farm.
I know, but just like sci-fi
evades the AI.
Sci-fi movie heaven, you get like the 50 smartest people from all different parts of the world and all different things, and they all program this totally. Thing to be like ethically whatever. And yeah. then I don't know.
No, for sure. For sure. It's yeah. It is such a complicated issue. And I mean, obviously we as individuals, we don't really, there's not a lot of power that we hold, but in terms of just like protecting ourselves from falling prey to misinformation in general, like maybe before we've, you know, seen it, whether we're on the right or the left or nowhere or neither, like what can we do to protect ourselves?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things. One is you can protect the information environment as a whole by being careful about what you share. So every time that you like, interact, or share with a piece of content, you're telling the algorithm, this is something people should see more of. And so you're in some ways in control of what other users see.
Right.
So I think that comes with some responsibility to be careful of what you're amplifying, what you're sharing. The other thing that can help is just to slow down. And actually think about accuracy and think about if what you're reading is likely to be true or false. So a lot of these shortcuts and heuristics become less powerful if you just take a moment to pause. So I like to tell people, whenever you see a post that makes you feel a really strong emotion, either really excited or really mad or really happy or really angry, that's the time to take a step back and pause and think about if what you're seeing is true.
Right. Unless it's dogs, in which case share.
Unless it's dogs, always share the dogs.
Or cats, Lola.
Or cats. Cats too. I think about Daniel Kahneman's book and this idea of system one versus system two thinking and how like we are able, although I did read in some of your research, it still doesn't get us, you know, where we want to be necessarily in terms of being able to identify falsehoods or whatever. But stopping and pausing and engaging in that slower form of thinking can do a great deal in terms of, you know, helping us not spread bad information.
Definitely.
Like, where did this come from? Who do I know that this is true? Do I, you know, is this a reliable source? That sort of thing, right? I mean, yeah, what kind of questions
exactly.
should we ask?
I think trying to figure out the source is a great one. There's interesting research on media literacy showing that if you ask kind of college students or US adults or even teenagers, kind of look at this website, determine if it's a reliable source, like, should you trust information from this website? What most people have been taught to do is to like scroll through the website, find an about page, check to see if it's a .org or a .com. Does it look kind of nicely put together? All of these that were decent cues for source trustworthiness 20 years ago and no longer are.
Right.
Instead, if you're a fact checker, what you do is you immediately leave the page and you go look up information on that source from other places.
Mm.
So you might throw the name of the news organization into Wikipedia.
Right.
Is it a real news organization? Does it pop up? Same thing with the name of the organization. Is it actually non-biased nonprofit, or is it a shell company run by the oil industry?
Right. I started noticing in the pandemic, I would like look up who wrote an article and they would have written no articles before that. And I was like, this is so weird. Like everyone, I don't understand. It was really strange.
So you've written about out of context photos and why they are such a spreader of misinformation on the internet. Can you just tell us more about that?
Yeah. So you often hear people worrying about deep fakes and these kind of complicated video algorithms that allow you to put someone else's face on someone else's body or make a politician say something that they never said. And there are definitely dangers there. But I make the argument that these cheap fakes and out of context photos can actually be way easier to spread and just as dangerous. So you see things like during the Ukraine war, footage from video games being posted as evidence of a missile attack.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you'll there's a photo of a park with like lots of trash after some sort of event that will often get posted as evidence after like an environmental protest. And they'll be like,
wow,
look, they didn't even clean up the park, those silly environmentalists.
Wow.
And it's really a photo from like a concert 10 years ago that's just getting reused in this new context.
Right.
I think we should mention the most important one, which was Miley Cyrus 2015 when they put a fake pregnancy test in her clear bag. And then she released pictures of herself with the same bag being like, there's no pregnancy, you know, whatever. Very scandalous for me at the time.
So we see basically like we shouldn't get our information from memes. I feel like that's a pretty good guideline.
But it's so fun.
Exactly. That's the problem. Like memes, when done well, can be an excellent source of good information because they're so easy to digest and clear and memorable.
And fake.
But those same things can also backfire.
Right. I want to know more about your research as far as like false memories. I actually didn't look up any of this really. I just like, it's an area that I find, it's a topic I find very interesting, especially given like the satanic panic. And now we're kind of experiencing another satanic panic where people sort of claim that they had experiences as a child that they most likely didn't have because they're wildly unrealistic. Did you? Teal Swan is one of them. Yeah.
She was sewn inside of a dead body.
Yeah, she claims she was sewn into a human body as a part of her satanic ritual abuse childhood, which a therapist who was a sort of chronic satanic ritual abuse uncoverer kind of led her to that conclusion. So do you have any did you look at that stuff at all?
So I haven't personally done any of the research on it. I was trained in grad school by someone who's done research on it. I do research on kind of kids' memories and things like that. So I also find the topic fascinating. You find that young children are particularly susceptible to creating these false memories, particularly when they're interviewed by people who have power over them or people who they view as authorities. So there's a great study that Stephen Cece did years ago where every day they have a kid come into the lab and they ask him, tell us about the time that your finger got caught in a mouse trap and you had to go to the hospital.
Mm.
And they just keep asking him about this event. And eventually he starts telling a story about it. And eventually he comes to believe this story, to the point that when he is home outside of the lab, he'll tell the story to his parents.
Wow.
And kind of details about where his brother was and exactly what happened, what it felt like. And none of it is actually true. In the clip, in one clip they show, the experimenters had told him, oh, this never happened to you. And a few weeks later, he was like, no, this is a real memory that I had.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, I think the satanic panics of the daycares in the 1980s really spurred a lot of research on children's memories and when they can be effective witnesses. Because when interviewed properly, kids can be an important witness, especially in sexual abuse cases. We don't want to go too far the other way and say
totally.
That kids should never be witnesses. But just like adults, kids are easily susceptible to this type of manipulation. One of the things that I find most heartbreaking about these cases is you have kids who, even if they were never abused, do have memories of that abuse.
Right. Which is the same as being abused.
Right.
They have trauma.
Which in many ways, psychologically, is still a form of trauma.
Right. That is so sad. And it is such a complicated situation because we obviously want to believe survivors. That should be the go-to. But then there are instances every once in a while of someone who was maybe manipulated at the wrong moment in time and believes a thing that, you know, we know didn't happen. I mean, again, much more rare, but that is why it is so important if you are in a position of power, if you're interviewing a child or a victim of any kind, to not ask leading questions and to be educated in the processes of memory, right? Well, so how do we know when to trust our memory if it's so malleable and every time we remember something, we're calling it up all over again? Like, how do we know, you know?
Basically, you don't. I think you should actually have the default that probably every memory you have is slightly different than how the event actually happened in reality.
Ooh. This is a question. Every time we think of a memory, do we change it a little bit? Is that true?
I think so.
Every time we remember something, we're changing that experience a little bit. And then the next time we remember it, it's a little bit different. And now we're just, it's such a like narrative therapy thing. I don't know. But
yeah, it makes me think about EMDR. Like you call up your memories and then you like edit them almost to make them easier to process, which is freaking mind blowing.
Because you've been just, as a child, you were doing even crazier processing shortcuts where you were just like, well, that's because I'm bad. Like, oh, that's because I'm stupid. And then now you're just like a human being who believes that. It's so interesting that we really don't know ourselves that well, maybe.
Yeah, I think memories that we retell a lot tend to kind of stabilize into a form that is pretty similar every time that we recall it. And there, what you find is that kind of the more often you recall it, the more memorable it is.
So we've
got this general finding. We call it retrieval practice. The things that you practice retrieving are the things that you're going to remember more often. We typically use it as like studying advice for students. Like, don't reread your notes. Test yourself on the material. Try and retrieve it from memory. But it also happens with our autobiographical memories. The things that you spend the most time remembering are the things that are going to be more memorable later on.
So could in theory, just like hypothesis here, and maybe this is a thing already, but practicing retrieving like positive memories or like affirming memories instead of the traumatic memories, like in, could that theoretically be like a useful therapeutic tool?
Yeah, theoretically. That makes sense given what we know about memory processing.
All right, let's do it. Megan, you and me.
Let's do it. We
invented a therapy. awesome. Well, is there anything that you would like people to know just about truth and memory and repetition in general that we haven't touched on?
I think we touched on most of it. It's kind of don't believe you're above it. Everyone can get fooled by misinformation when it's the right piece of misinformation. These are just basic processes. The way that our brain works makes us vulnerable to it. When you see something that causes a big emotional reaction, slow down, try and figure out if it's true or false, and don't be so quick to share or interact with things that might not be true.
Love it.
Do you ever fall prey to misinformation?
Anymore? Oh, yeah.
All the time? Every time?
I don't know
just
about
like
all the time, but I definitely get fooled still sometimes.
That's
yeah.
Amazing. Okay. Good. That makes me feel
better.
Because
we all do. We all do.
I know we all do, but man,
even
to
when
have
you research
your job
it,
and it still just flies through there, it
I
makes
know.
Me feel a little bit better. Cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Are you on social media? Do you want to share any place on the internet where
you
are?
I'm on Twitter at LK Fazio.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Wonderful. Take care.
Okay.
Ooh.
Well, that was Lisa. And now it's time for Megan.
Yes.
To tell me. Okay. So do you, can you think of any examples of times that you have like heard something enough times that it starts to have an impact on your thinking?
I mean, she is so wonderful and great. It's interesting to me because I tend to stick to my first opinion in a way that's pretty insane. I'm not proud of that. So I feel like if I think something, no matter what I hear, how often I hear it, I just dig in deeper.
Well, that makes sense because we also talked about the primacy effect.
I
believe it was called. Am I getting that right? Which is that the first thing you hear is the thing that sticks.
Yeah.
So it makes, maybe it's like before you've formed an official opinion on something.
I mean, she said though, even if you think it's really true and you're really passionate about it, if you hear it a bunch, something different, it will start to sink in. And I believe her. I just consciously haven't connected to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she did also say, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder like how far it extends in either direction. Cause she did also say that like, once you have the bad information stuck in your head, it's like really, it's like hard to unlearn it.
That's, yeah, that's where I get stuck, yeah. I'm sure, where I'm like, nope.
I also wonder like how, like maybe it still has some effect because it's easier for your brain to process if it's coming from your out-group, but I would imagine it's got to be a smaller effect.
Yeah,
right.
It feels that way, but
because that, like, that was sort of what Chris Bale's research spoke to, which is that like people would kind of, if it came from their out group or whatever, people would kind of dig their heels in deeper with the in group belief. So I don't know. Social science is very interesting.
Crosses. Yeah, it's all very interesting. But
I'm sure we'll be learning more very soon, later this month, for the rest of Conspiracy Month.
Oh, I can't wait. Thank you guys so much for being here. We can't wait to see you again next week. And as always, remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags,
and never, ever trust me.
Bye.
Bye. Trust Me is produced by Kirsten Woodward, Gabby Rapp, and Steve Delamater.
With special thanks to Stacey Para.
And our theme song was composed by Holly Amber Church.
You can find us on Instagram at Trust Me Podcast, Twitter at Trust Me Cult Pod, or on TikTok at Trust Me Cult Podcast.
I'm Ula Lola on Instagram and Ola Lola on Twitter.
And I am Megan Elizabeth 11 on Instagram and Babraham Hicks on Twitter.
Remember to rate and review and spread the word.